Okay, now, definitely not to belabor this one because it's very, very wonky. But the bottom line is, when we talk about the risk of long-term care use of services, whether it's from the family or particularly if I'm using formal services, we're really talking about not just how likely am I to have this, the probability that I'll need these services, but how expensive they would be, right? So in insurance, if you think about it, if we use the strongest sense, the whole notion of insurance is something that is not a sure thing that it's going to happen, or at least it's not a sure thing during a specific window of time, right? I am going to die. It's just I don't know when I'm going to die, okay? And I pay in money, and I suppose one can imagine that every day, I hope my wife feels the same way about this, that every day I open my eyes back up and God's given me another day on the planet, I hope my first response is, stink, I spent that life insurance premium again. Right? Because the underlying notion was, I expected this to be an unlikely event, but I paid into it because that unlikely event could and will one day occur, right? And then there will be those dollars to be able to go to my wife. We won't go any further about what her feelings would be about all of that. So same sort of deal here, that in terms of my key point I'm trying to get across, human beings have a really tough time with this. Being able to see yourself in the future or see somebody else you love in the future and make any kind of deliberative, thoughtful assessment of what's the probability that I'm going to need this expensive thing. That is not easy to do. Actuaries develop a science. They use the machines in front of them in part to overcome the effect of what comes in their mind when they're trying to do this. What we've concluded is that we as emotional beings, we as beings who are complex in terms of our feelings and our sense about time, are not particularly good at this stuff. There's none of us, at least some in the room, I know I'm not dating by using a Star Trek reference, we're not Mr. Spock. Right? We don't have that ability to all of a sudden turn off all of our feelings, turn off our memories, turn off our sense of who this person is, and just look at this coldly. It's not particularly something that we're very good at as human beings. And so in doing so, we sometimes miss out on opportunities. We delay too long, or we impulsively act in ways that don't make a whole lot of sense. So my point here is, if it was possible, I assure you, if it was possible to convince you about risk of long-term care need and cost for it, and it could be done completely deliberatively, every one of you guys would end up having a successful conversation, at least from their perspective, with a long-term care insurance agent. Because they would have thrown all the numbers at you, you'd be overwhelmed by them, you'd be like, oh my gosh, all right, what do I have to pay? But that hasn't happened. Single digits of us have moved forward in any way in terms of trying to consider that type of funding. We'll talk a little bit about that. Is that in part because the numbers don't make sense? Is it in part because we're just not particularly good with trying to put ourselves into those numbers and think about those risks, or our parents into those numbers and with those risks, because all of the other feelings kind of get up in the way? Okay. As I mentioned to you before, home care is principally done out of pocket, out of opportunity cost. Families doing things for somebody and hence sustaining not doing something else in all of it. But there are, as you know, home care services that could be brought. Now, I want to be very clear. We're going to talk a little bit about Medicare and what Medicare does not pay for. Okay? When you see the nurses coming post-hospitalization and they're coming to do treatments of some sort, their IV therapies, things like that, okay? That's not what we're referring to relative to, right, the bathing, dressing, toileting, and so on. They may be doing that. They may be bringing along a home health aide to provide those services as a part of that package during that time. But the reason that they're walking in that door, as we'll talk about when we talk about Medicare, is because there's some kind of convalescence going on. There's a rehab, a restorative process going on. Here, what I'm talking about is sustained home care. You've seen the services. You've probably heard the commercials on the radio, depending upon what you're listening to, of different services that provide custodial assistance, non-medical, non-Medicare services that are provided out in the homes, okay? Community-based respite. Most people would argue that if you can find it, the great deal out there is daycare. Don't particularly like using the same term as we use for children. There's an element of respect that kind of gets under my skin a little bit in that. But the notion of a place that somebody could go to for multiple hours during the day with people who actually know something about that type of person and how to help care for them and develop a relationship with that person is pretty powerful. And when you're talking about something that could be, with a little bit of subsidy, as cheap as $25 a day, generally $50, $60 a day, if you do it comparatively, that's a pretty good deal overall. The issue is being able to get those, expand those. In many cases, the ones that have been successful have huge amounts of subsidy. And their subsidy may be because they're affiliated with someplace else that has an economic interest in it, okay? Could be that it's a care facility that is also running the daycare. Well, you know, you're building bullpen, guys. You know, I mean, I get it, okay, and all of that. It might be a hospital system, the same thing. The hospital system wants to make sure you remember us. Don't forget us. We're the people that, we're your doctors and your place you go with your Medicare dollars, okay? And so be it. Might be charitable organizations of different sorts. But day programs are an example of the kinds of community-based respite services. And go ahead, yes. Yes. For the purpose of the recording, I'll make sure. I absolutely affirm, when there is a successful day program of that sort, relationships are built. And particularly if there is dementia involved or early dementia involved, as is often the case, and many of these programs are designed with that consideration in it, you got an environment that's known and safe. It starts to feel contextually right. And so in this case, the great illustration that if I pull out of that context, even if it's to go see family members whom I love, I'm being thrown into their house with their sounds and their kids and their dog and everything else that's all new and strange and can be very challenging. Legitimately moving around the resources into the way that makes the greatest sense. But what a great testimony, right, to when a service is working well, is that an older adult, particularly a cognitively frail older adult, would start to become a part of that and really feel connected there. And the freedom that then provides to the family member to, you know, one of the great concerns that some of us have that are, you know, either professionals or researchers in this area is an increasing concern about the amount of neglect, particularly health promotion, health maintenance neglect in spousal caregivers. To some degree, we're finding it more and more also in adult child caregivers. I mean, if you think about it, an adult child caregiver, particularly of a female parent, is, I'm using this intentionally, herself, because it usually is herself, okay? But himself or herself is also a person who's in midlife, and they have their own chronic illnesses that they need to deal with. So to have a place where you feel not only is this therapeutic, and it is, okay, it's also safe respite, that means that, you know, whether it's that treadmill or that doctor's appointment, right, whether it's that budgeting and taking care of your bills, that gives the isolated time to be able to do those other things that if they weren't done, think proactively, if they weren't done, now we have another family mess to deal with, either in terms of those unneglected activities or those neglected activities and untaken care of. Okay, so assisted living facilities and nursing homes, I talked a little bit about the distinction there. The key to remember in all of this is there may be a substantial overlap clinically in terms of what these places can do. But in many cases, not wholly, but in many cases, the vast majority of assisted living facilities do not have a public assistance program attached to them. The vast majority of nursing homes do. Okay? So that often is a single biggest distinction, and very different regulatory constraints, particularly depending upon the state. In some states like Ohio, there's a lot more regulation on the assisted living facilities. In some other states, it's very, very loose. Assisted living, incidentally, if you're thinking about that big, I almost said a trade name. If you think about that big place that you drive past, not far from here or in the neighborhoods in which you live, think more broadly. You probably passed two adult care homes on your way here. You didn't even know that they were. 3 to 6 or 6 to 30 older adults living in the same space. You drive by them all the time. If you live in a neighborhood, as I do, okay, I live proudly, I say, in the Larchmere district of Cleveland, just above the hill, above University Circle, you're welcome to come and join us for Porch Fest in a couple of weeks. In any case, it's a neighborhood, right, where there's some economic strain, and there's big old houses. And there are lots of duplexes, lots of houses that have extra bedrooms. There is a, you know, we need to remember that while there may be in these five counties of PSA 10, which is kind of our region here for social services in Cuyahoga Lake, Geauga, Lorain, and Medina counties, there might be, I'm doing this off the top of my head, there might be 150, 160, something like that, of those assisted living facilities. There's nearly 500 adult care homes. So you didn't even know they're there. It is at their best, they are amazing. They are a home, family home, pass the potatoes, even if the person actually couldn't remember how to use the fork to do the potatoes, okay? They're beautiful. They're incredible. They're often middle-aged or aging couples themselves who are looking after folks who otherwise would be getting this at home, but they don't have the home to be able to do that. They also, as you can imagine, being a relatively shadow industry, they also, the worst of the worst, will be there. And it's scary places. Yes? Yeah. Because by definition, these folks don't have enough, it wouldn't be worth, they're not making enough profit margin to be able to put ads in the newspaper to say, right? And it's word of mouth and so on and so forth. Yes, great question. How do you find out? You find out here in our area, in those five counties that I just mentioned, no, in any, you find out through the Area Agency on Aging. In our case, it happens to be they're called the Western Reserve Area Agency on Aging. They're based in downtown Cleveland, and they handle those five counties. There's also an exceptionally good Area Agency on Aging for Summit and Stark County that's based, I believe, in Uniontown. Might actually be in Akron at this point. But we're very blessed in that regard that we have some really excellent gerontology professionals who are running this. They are deeply, deeply committed to the ethical code, if you will, for the particularly for the housing folks, okay? But overall, at the Area Agency on Aging, is how do we allow older adults to live the least restrictive life they possibly can? So they, many cases, while the state does not regulate those adult care homes and adult foster homes, the Area Agency on Aging has their own oversight, and they're diligent about it. And they're diligent about it for two reasons. Not just because they're trying to avoid the worst of the worst, but they're trying to promote the best of the best. So that there is, if you will, other alternatives for folks for housing that's less restrictive than a care facility and also, frankly, less expensive than some of the private assisted living facilities. Okay? How we doing on time? Okay, good. I'm going to go a couple more minutes, then we'll take a break, okay? So let me run through quickly through payment options. All right, everybody tracking with me so far? We okay? We're good? All right. When I did my MBA, we used to refer to this as OPM. Your money versus OPM, other people's money. I'm going to start with your money, okay? If you're going to pay for long-term care, whether that's paying for long-term care indefinitely, whether it's paying for it in the community versus in a facility, you're hiring somebody to come into the home, you're going out to the day programs as we talked about, any of the options that we've talked about, okay? If you're paying out of pocket, whether that is for a temporary period of time, because you're also moving toward eligibility for a public benefit and you're not there yet, or whether it's because you have substantial resources and a public benefit program is not, you're not eligible for that, or frankly, you're naive and ignorant of the fact that you are eligible for public benefits, you didn't know it, and so you're paying anyway. And I want to emphasize all three of those possibilities exist, more than probably we recognize. These are your sources. No surprise, duh, this is kind of straightforward. Personal income. Well, very quickly, if you'll notice, any substantial amount of care services, when we start to talk about the costs of those care, all right? So ballpark, heuristic, don't quote me on this one, all right, but here you go. Roughly think in the range of $20 an hour for home care services. and roughly think that on average, now you can start to figure this through, 20 to 40 hours a week is about what people end up buying. So you do the math on this and you start to get an idea of what kinds of expenditures are there, okay? Assisted living facilities, meaning full-time, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, at, if you will, a lower level of need than the nursing home, but as we said before, could be a substantial amount of overlap, depending upon the person is, but less of the medical, less registered nurse oversight, more practical nurse, if nurse at all, depending upon the facility, okay? The residential care facility, assisted living, what we call here in Ohio, start to think in the range of around $4,000 to $5,000 a month. Okay, that gives you a rough idea, okay? So what are we talking about for nursing home? Nursing home, we're talking about $6,500 to $8,000 a month. All right, now, I don't know what your income is. Some of you, your parents may have had substantial pensions and done great, and God bless them for it. Good, 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 good. I'm so glad, because it's somebody else's that doesn't have to pay this money. But the bottom line is, I have very few human beings that I've ever interacted with that as care progressed, they could afford that from personal income. They were reaching into resources other than that, reaching into assets. They were burning down their savings in some form or another. That's a substantial amount of income. To the point being, if they had that much income before they got sick, what were they doing with all of it? And so, now, to be clear, that's in the Northeast Ohio area where we tend to have folks that are more modest means, moderate means in that regard. But that's the first place that we go. Second place we go, obviously, is reaching into personal savings and invested assets. Now that is not necessarily simple, and I don't want to kind of go too deep into the finance piece of it, but some of you who may already be acquainted with those can imagine. If I've been holding that Apple stock since 2 years into the time that they came around, all right, and now I need to start selling that Apple stock now, some of you who know a little bit of finance know, I'm going to take that huge capital gain right now, all of which is going to be taxable. I really was kind of hoping to be able to hold on to that until I could pass it on to my kids. And then if they wanted to sell it, there was a step up in the cost basis and all that tax didn't have to go away. I got all that value to them. I don't want to sell that. Well, you want the care or you not want the care? Is this making sense? So it's when we start talking about reaching into the portfolio and savings, not that many people all have it sitting around in cash. Even those that do might, old school investors, right? They might have it in CDs or bonds or annuities, deferred annuities that have limitations on how much they can take out without penalties or how fast they can take it out. Well, the rainy day has arrived, and depending upon what's going on, it's like pouring and thundering and lightning. And at that point, all of a sudden, all of the well-played made plans of mice and men in terms of how you were going to manage the taxation, particularly of getting these assets out, might need to get thrown out the window. And it takes a good bit of financial sophistication. Some of my best gigs, frankly, are instances where I'm working alongside a CPA, and we are working about what we bleed out and in what order and how we do that. And trying to think through a strategy to try to preserve the wealth as good stewards as best as we possibly can, recognizing that this is a problem that we need to deal with. We can't avoid it, okay? Yes, except for the fact, and I'm looking more toward the future on that with regard to Roth IRAs, because as you can imagine, it was really sort of the early baby boomers that first started to recognize the Roth rules and the potential for it, and there was almost an ethos about taxation that's kind of drove the rise of people using, not to get too wonky on you guys, but you know, the notion of putting money in, paying taxes on the front end into an IRA vehicle, but then not having a taxable on the back end. I mean, that would be a powerful vehicle, you could imagine, if at the time of your lower income, and we've had, and over the years, I've worked with clients, where we intentionally, in and around the time of their retirement, incidentally, note, for those who are considering doing a few years of ministry work, unpaid ministry work, after you retire, it's a great time to do all those Roth conversions, okay? And if it, you know, increases the likelihood, there you go. There's your 10, 15, 20% incentive to be able to go and not take a salary for a while, go do some great things for the Lord, have a tax benefit that comes out of it. But in any case, those folks, yeah, that now have a lot of their wealth in Roth, changes the dynamics in terms of being able to reach it out. But that would be true of anything where, I mean, you can imagine, guys, walk it through, right? For the most part, if somebody's that sick, they also have some pretty hefty healthcare deductions. So after about 7.5%, 10%, depending upon of those bills, the rest of it is all tax deductible. So when I say I'm working a lot with CPAs on this or accountants on this, it's because, frankly, we're matching it up. You know what? I'm the guy with the whole big stack of medical bills in front to be able to justify, you know, come every February, March, doing all of this work of what we're going to offset in terms of expenses for it. So why am I pointing it out to you guys? And why am I seeing some of you with a worried look or a disdainful look on your face? It's because you know it's complex, and I got other things to think about. And you know, I probably didn't do that so well for mom and dad last year, did I? And maybe the year before. And I guess I wish I had more time to be able to be more thoughtful about doing these things. And it's not, so even when we're saying, oh yeah, you've got the money to pay for it, how you have the money changes it. And how we bring that money out in terms of good stewards changes it. How long I can get the services. I love this assisted living facility, but they're not in Medicaid. I want mom to stay here for as long as possible. I like this daycare and this home situation. I just need more of it, okay? And so the idea is not we're saving the money so that we can pass on estate. Not that that's a bad thing. That's actually honored within the scriptures as saying that's a good thing to do, okay? But it's not the money itself. What we're talking about, the uses of the money is what we're focused on here. And so being good stewards by not having to pay to render to Caesar any more than we have to render to Caesar is wise, right? It's good stewardship in that regard. But it takes a thoughtfulness, it takes a planning, and in the midst of providing the care, in the midst of loving my parents, that's a pretty tricky time to all of a sudden step back and whiteboard out the plan with me. It's easier if I've already structured it ahead of time and now I'm following the cookbook when the pressure gets up, okay? Just to be clear, the other sources, home equity, particularly through the use of a reverse mortgage, is something to be considered and to be considered carefully, okay? There is that this was an industry that became highly exploitative, became a real problem. People sucking all the equity out of their houses to go then purchase large annuities that end up locking up their money for periods of time. It was some really, really bad stuff going on. But in its fundamental core, now with a new set of regulations looking after it that I hope are frankly not undone in the next few years of our lives, there were some protections put in place that somebody with increasing age, and in some cases with increasing disability, you could reach into the equity that has built up in your house, pull that money out, to be able to use it for your care needs. It's not a dollar for dollar. There's fees in the midst of this thing. There's costs as it goes through. There's limitations on it. And frankly, the biggest thing is, if the heart was set on passing that house down to the kids, the house will now be encumbered. It'll have a mortgage, if you will. The kids either can pay back that money that was sucked out of it, or you know, they will now have a less valuable property, because there was a mortgage, if you will, that was taken on it. It's just rather than a mortgage being a large amount of money that you're paying down over time, it was a little bit of money that you've been building up over time, depending on how long that time takes. You with me? The good news of it is, for the right family, for the right circumstance, this is a mortgage that we back as a society. We say we'd like older adults to be able to stay in their homes if they physically possibly can in this. And so we're going to incentivize that. So what does that mean? Well, that means if the house loses value over time, right? So I gave out the mortgage to the family that was living in East Cleveland 20 years ago, okay? And they were right on the edge of the Forest Hills neighborhood, and the house was valued at $80,000, and it was kind of all good. We're fine. Everything's good there. And you know what? That house is now worth $15,000. That upside down circumstance, we're not going to penalize the older adult. Who's going to pay for that other $65,000? We did. We did, because we said, you know what? It was worth it to us to have that social good of the possibility of that older lady staying in that house for that period of time. So there is a program there that is worth looking at very, very, very carefully for the right person in that regard, okay? Because that is a source of wealth that gets built up. Remember, we also have, in our society, we have certain sources of wealth that we attach different kinds of meaning to, right? You know? I mean, some people consider themselves to be stock investors. All right? And then you listen to it, and what you find out is they have this nice little portfolio that they play with, and they watch CNBC all day and Bloomberg all day, and they jump on and they do trades, and good for you. That's great. And then you discover that the other guy who says, I know nothing about stocks, as it turns out, has a substantial amount sitting in his 401k that somebody else is just kind of churning around and working with. Well, who's the greater stock investor in all of that? The one who toys around with it and I don't know. But the point is, it's the same sort of thing here. Each asset has a different value attached to it. Let us be clear that the greatest generation had a strong, strong attachment to wealth attached to housing. It is, and I'm no anthropologist, I'm no cultural commentator, but I know well enough to know that when you come back after having gone through a devastating economic period that we have never known in our lifetimes, okay, and most of us in this room, I think maybe somebody's been on the cusp of it, but not likely, okay? And then you had, after the war that was supposed to end all wars, you had the war. And you watched all that went through during those years. Getting that little brick building in Euclid or Parma or Fairview Park, or you pick your spot, okay, in Cleveland, meant a lot. It was, and I don't know if any of you are of a position of the generation, but I remember the mortgage burning parties. I remember when the neighbors would pay off the last of it, and it was an event in the neighborhood as I was growing up in the little cookie cutter post-war houses that I grew up in, right, where that meant something. So we need to be clear in our minds that meaning something may be, honey, I'm going to pass this on to you. Now, you never said anything back that your house is actually, you know, 2,000 square feet bigger than that right now, and you would never go back to that old neighborhood. It's just not the place that you are any longer. But you know what? And you smiled, and you said, Mom, that's great, you know, because you took it as what it was. I love you. I care about your security, and I don't want you ever to have a day of insecurity like I went through. And this house meant something to me in that regard. So it's important for us to make sure that we're weaving our way through. Stuff is just stuff, but stuff can have meaning attached to it that's more than stuff. It's an expression of something. It's an expression of value. It's an expression of things that can then be tied back to, yeah, Mom, and how does God look at that thing? What does this mean in light of the fact that we're all eternal spiritual beings living a human experience right now? Okay? Life insurance as well as a source that folks can go to without belaboring it. Okay, why did I do this one particularly? This particular slide strikes through Medicare, and that is very important. If there's any single thing I want you to walk from here is to remember that the vast majority of what we've been talking about in terms of these types of services are not paid by the health insurance for folks who are over 65, blind and disabled, and have end-stage renal disease. Medicare is medical insurance. It is in its form A, that is for hospitals, and B, that is for providers, and we don't talk about C, that's kind of a little different, and D, for pharmaceuticals, okay? That Medicare is for medical services. It is not for assisting somebody with living with the disabilities, except for a short period of time after those medical services. If you're getting better, if you're recouping, if you're rehabbing, if you're making your way back up, Medicare is relevant to you. If you've now at this point, sorry to use this term, it's the one in the industry, plateaued, you are where you are. This is palliative, this is supportive. This is assisting you with function. It is custodial. I hate all of those words, but we don't have any better ones, okay? You're now running tide instead of wave, okay? You are no longer being paid for by Medicare. And there's pretty strict rules to make sure that that's the case. Some people have purchased long-term care insurance to be able to do this. It's relatively few people. And if we want to, we can talk about some of the dynamics of long-term care insurance. If you yourself, the market for long-term care insurance, interestingly, is principally a market to middle-aged folks. It is also a shrinking market. It kind of went like little to a lot, and then a number of the large insurance companies, John Hancock, MetLife, and some others, got very involved even on the group side, federal employees, state employees, so on and so forth, and their actuaries are freaking right now. There was not, I think it's a fair statement, there was not a clarity in their mind about how expensive this care was, how many people were going to use it, how many people were actually going to buy their policy and hang on to it even if I kept increasing the price. This has not been done well in terms of an insurance problem in our society. And accordingly, for some people, it may be the most expensive least valuable insurance that, frankly, you can't live without, because you have a high risk and because you're in that both social and clinical phenomena that your risk is very high. But to be clear, it's a messed up market right now. It's a very unstable market right now. And as we'll talk about in a little bit, there's hybrid options starting to be developed about it. It kind of started out in a very term sort of model. Now we're finding more and more connections to life insurance and some other things that may actually breathe some new life into that industry. Please. Yep. Yeah, we the middle-aged, okay? Well, here's the challenge. Yeah, the market, I'm 55 years old. I'm like perfect for the market for long-term care insurance. And hence, I hear a lot about it in that regard. And the challenge is, right, that I can purchase a policy that's built in the same way like a health insurance policy might be built. You know, so every year or every month I pay for this thing, and if I don't use it, that premium is gone. But because of that, I had a chance on losing it. It also is less expensive. But less expensive might still be $400 a month, $600 a month. Significant portion of my budget directed toward this, okay? Depending upon what services I wanted and for how long I wanted to purchase that, okay? If I buy too little, it's going to be meaningless to me, okay? If I buy a lot, it's going to be expensive right now, and I might not ever use it. But the other piece is that market always left open, in most cases, unless you fully paid it up, which might cost you twice or three times that each month to fully pay this thing up over a period of time, had the risk of prices increasing. Now, normally, you don't increase prices on customers if you want new customers. But what started to happen is more and more companies were looking out ahead and saying, I don't know how we're going to make money off of this. This is really risky. Why don't we just stick with stuff we know? People dying, we know. Even people getting sick, we kind of understand that business. But this notion of somebody at some point in time maybe using these services and they get to decide and they can go to any one of those different types of services and I don't have much control over that and I don't know how to necessarily deal with that risk. I don't know how to make sense of that. They started pulling out of the market. So one after another company either stopped selling policies, but they still exist as a life insurance company or a health insurance company, or they got out of the market completely. They don't do this any longer. Well, at that point, the only disincentive that you have, the only means that you have not to jam prices on your existing customers, is the Department of Insurance. And so depending upon who that Department of Insurance is in that particular state, we started watching premiums. Initial, you know, 10, 15, 20% increases, then 50% increases, 60% increases, driving folks out of the market, if you will, to drop your policy. I'll make this expensive enough that you stop your policy. And it's been a challenge. It's been a challenge because, as you can imagine, folks will be coming to me in their 70s at a time considerably closer to when they actually might need to use this. And they said, I now have to pay once and a half what I had to pay before in premiums. Should I do it? Should I drop my policy or should I continue to pay? Should I reach into my savings to do this? These are relatively complex analyses to do for people in terms of being able to say, you know, well, let's look at your potential risk. What is the relationship between probability and cost? That thing that we said before, human beings don't do very well on their own with their minds, and try to lay it out on paper, spreadsheet this thing out, put it together in terms of some numbers so that we have some kind of guides to be able to then prayerfully make a decision that you're going to be able to be comfortable with. Okay? I wanted to point out, though, there's an emerging market for those who can afford it or for those who are in a position to be able to do it, where there are ability to be able to buy life insurance-based products that where rather than just, you know, the money goes to somebody upon your death, in your life you're actually able to reach into that death benefit and use that for those disability services in that. You know, it's always been around for folks that maybe were terminally ill, but these are increasingly now we have policies that have these riders attached to them. They're a little bit more expensive. But if you had a life insurance need, even if it's a temporary life insurance need, but you know what, in the end, it's the disability and your need for the long-term care that really would drive this, those can work out, those hybrids can work out to be really, really useful in that regard, to be able to reach into that policy, to be able to do it. Okay, and I can talk a little bit more about that later if we wish. Okay? Other people's money. In general, the sources that we go to for, remember, what's the source that we don't use, guys? Medicare. Okay? Medicare is not going to apply to this. Okay. But if you have served our country honorably and discharged accordingly, the VA does have some services in a different way. Unlike, say, the Medicaid program that will pay whatever it needs to based on the need that you have. The Veterans Administration has a more restrictive benefit, but it's one that, frankly, is often underutilized. They have the aid and attendance program of the VA as a pension. It's a disability pension that, surprisingly, if you have a care need, folks can end up applying for because of the needs of the disability end up overwhelming the first restrictions of getting a pension in the first place. Now, the biggest restriction is this was a benefit that was only given to veterans who served at least one day, I guess, served during a combat period. So there's specific guidelines in it. And sadly, there are some veterans who honorably serve. You didn't have to serve in a combat theater. You just had to serve during that period of time. So for veterans of World War II, for veterans of Korea during that window of time, and it's continued on, this is applicable. If you happen to serve very honorably, but you served in the window of time between those combat periods, this benefit is not eligible. Yeah, great question. It is also surviving spouses, widows and widowers of veterans would also be eligible. It's not as rich a benefit for those folks as it is for the person who actually served. But yes, there are some continuing. And again, we're talking about a pension. You know, we're talking about a fixed amount of money per month to be able to go to this person. It's not a no ceiling, we'll take care of your care needs kinds of thing. But for the right folks, it can take the edge off and allow them to continue with community-based out-of-pocket services for a longer period of time because of that benefit. And more importantly, I think, you know, maybe this is my bias, but these people served. You know, this is one of the things that we as a society have said is a right and a good thing to do on the basis of the fact that, you know, they put themselves or allow themselves the potential to be put in harm's way for all of our benefit. It is. And I don't know if this is good news or bad news, but it's the income eligibility requirements that are probably markedly lower than your income are offset, because they're pretty low, whatever, $1,500 a month or $1,200 a month or something like that, are offset by the disability piece. So in other words, if I have to make my way down to, I'll use it as simple numbers, if I had to make my way to less than $1,000 a month, okay? But I actually have $3,000 a month that's coming in. But I have anything greater than $2,000 a month of disability expenses that I'm paying out of pocket for my assisted living and things like that, I'm eligible. Because that amount that I'm spending on those healthcare expenditures drives down. And that's the piece of a lot of folks. They'll go to the first page of the VA website. And actually, compared to the Social Security Administration, I'll work with the VA all day long. But these are not necessarily, you're with me on that one. But these are not necessarily easy agencies even to talk to somebody, much less to talk to somebody who knows what they're talking about, okay, sadly. But in any case, the biggest danger are folks that then don't go to that next level. To say, well, wait a second, then how could anybody apply for this? Do I already have to be really poor to be able to do this? So you're hearing me right now. These are disability offsets, you know? So in other words, if I have a moderate income every month, but I have a substantial amount of care need and care expenses that go with it, I will probably have a good chance of driving myself down into eligibility for something that would generally otherwise only be available to somebody that had a low amount of income every month. Yeah, the unless they are generating income at the time and making into that, one of the interesting things about the VA programs is that they tend to have a much more liberal perspective about resources, about other assets in this, and are more heavily based on income. Furthermore, and this is I'm glad you brought it up, this is a dangerous point. If you are in excess, you have investments, wealth in excess. So like most of the public eligibility programs, they may remove out your house from even consideration in it and stuff like that. But let's say you have a pretty decent sized investment portfolio in it. The VA, right now at least, has no rules that you can't take that money and go give it to somebody. Put it in, give it to your kid and have them put it into a trust someplace for your future benefit, and bingo, you're eligible all of a sudden. I'm not speaking to the morality of that right now. I'm just saying that that's within their rules to be able to do that. Of course, if you did that and your pension didn't suffice in a few months, okay, or even a few years, and you needed to go to Medicaid, if that transfer had been made in 5 years prior to Medicaid, you might get actually, I don't know, we'll do this more in detail later, you would be deemed ineligible for Medicaid because of that very same transfer. So the one federal program says, I don't care. The other federal program says, I care a lot. And the difficulty is what may seem logical at first, you don't actually know what the next few years ahead of you are like, right? And now we're back in this space that human minds have a real difficult time being able to do with these probabilities, okay? So my reason I'm pointing it out right now, not to get overly complex in this thing, and we all need a break for a second here, but is that you can imagine families getting themselves twisted. Hey, Dad, this is great. Look, we'll bring it in. The lawyer can help us. We'll do the transfer. You give it to all of us. We'll put it in a trust for you. We'll hold it. You could get your VA benefits. I have been there. Frankly, it was a brother who I love dearly, and he and his siblings could not get past the brilliance of this idea. My warning to them was, your dad's condition is not static. Your dad's condition is progressive. Are you quite sure that you guys are in a position to be able to handle this, okay? And he said, yeah, no problem, no problem. At least, I am thanking God, I convinced them to work with an attorney that had them take these dollars out of their individual possession as siblings and at least place it into a combined trust that had some rules on it. Because I can swear to you that would have ended up paying for kids' education, the roof on the house, and Dad would have been like, sure, of course, honey, yes. See, that's what the money's for. You do that, okay? Because, yes, he ended up having greater care needs than we were able to care for with the pension. They had to reach into those funds, pull out those funds, and pay out of pocket until the time had elapsed that they would be eligible for Medicaid. So working those two programs together, working any public benefits programs together, by definition, you kind of want to lean toward the more restrictive program as your guide to be able to figure out how you're going to make this whole thing work together, okay? Let's see. VA, there are respite services both within the county. We have a program here in Cuyahoga County, though I'm not quite right now at this moment, over there in Cuyahoga County. There is a program called Options where folks, if they're not financially eligible for the Medicaid program, they can provide some of these similar services through the Area Agency on Aging for you and through the county. Obviously, there are philanthropic organizations that provide respite services, hit or miss over the years, both religious-based philanthropic services and also the Alzheimer's Association, folks like that, specific associations. Medicaid and Medicaid waiver. I'm just going to explain the distinction between those two real fast because we'll have a chance to talk more about Medicaid in a little bit if you wish to, okay? Medicaid is the public assistance program for folks who have care needs of any sort and are indigent. As I shared with you before, at a macro level, the vast majority of incidentally, Medicaid is a joint federal-state program. Okay, I won't go into the specifics on the public financing of how it ended up in the situation that it's in right now, but the whole idea was it was always supposed to be both sources provided for it, and it was administered through the state down at the county level. Okay? That's how it works. So in our case, it would be the Department of Jobs and Family Services of Ohio has offices based within the counties. to be able to administrate the Medicaid program. And this includes folks who just need, they need that Medicaid card because that's how they go to the doctor to get their preventative care, to get their medications, things like that, as well as folks who are living in long-term care facilities and receiving 24-hour care through that. The Medicaid program, as you can imagine, has both income and asset eligibility requirements, and they have a very, very relatively complex and defined set of rules about how to be eligible, how to stay eligible over time to be able to receive these services. But if you are, then the services that you are receiving under traditional Medicaid don't have limits on them. So in other words, if you are receiving care in a care facility, a licensed nursing facility that also has Medicaid provided to it, and frankly, you have complicated, pricey care, you need a lot of care, once having met that eligibility requirements, the taxpayers will make sure that that's provided for. And we have had multiple efforts over the years to make sure that the care providers themselves were compensated but not overcompensated. That's a constant cat and mouse kind of game of what those regulations look like to make sure that we're adequately taking care of those folks. Okay? Medicaid waiver, and it seems odd, I suppose one would say, isn't it, Richard, isn't it a little weird that you need a waiver to get something that people prefer to have and is less expensive? Home care services and, in a small level, assisted living services, assisted living facility services, there are Medicaid programs to be able to pay for that. Here in Northeast Ohio, we call it Passport. Passport is where, if someone meets the eligibility, there's slightly different eligibility criterion, but if you have a home care situation where, frankly, you need a nurse to come in and supervise things, you need a home health aide to come in to help with the bath and things like that, that's not something that you can necessarily do. Meals on Wheels might be really nice because that's just not necessarily something that you can easily do. But those services would allow you to take somebody who otherwise would need to go to a care facility and they could live at home. And you've got somebody there, yourself possibly, to open the door and make sure these folks get in and keep things safe at night and so on and so forth. But if you had those services in, you think you can make it at home. And that person meets the financial requirements, that's Passport. That's a Medicaid waiver program. That is Medicaid at home. And the only rules that they've got on it, and it is incidentally run, that specific program, is run back through that area agency on aging that we talked about before that is so bent on keeping people in their homes, right? And so it's a nice fit in that regard. It's a, you know, it's always a political football at budget time about how much money we're going to put into this, how much not, because people find it more desirable and attractive. And some public finance people are concerned, you know what, the sad as this sounds, you know, the less attractive option of the nursing home maybe has kept more people doing it at home, paying out of their own pockets and doing it with their own family care. If I make it too easy for them to get public benefits at home, maybe they're going to use up too much of the money. And there's always been that kind of tension, okay? But not talking to the sort of public finance and public ethics of this thing, from our perspective, what it means is that if you are in a situation where the home could work, you've got the right bodies in place to be able to do this thing, and you could organize that, but you need specifically somebody to provide certain care services, homemaking services, and you'd be amazed. Building a ramp to get a wheelchair through, all kinds of other kinds of assisted services that could be a part of it. If there's eligibility met at the income and assets level, so these are, you know, folks that are in need financially as well, this is a great program. It's a perfect program for that. Their restrictions are they're not allowed to spend more than 60% of what it would cost for a nursing home. Well, I just told you before, the nursing home number is plus or minus $7,000 a month. So, you know, north of $4,000 a month of services for a lot of folks could make a huge difference in their life and make it worthwhile to make this work, okay, if it can work, all right? So if for some of you who said, well, but I don't want to think about the nursing home piece, I may have just piqued your interest in whether there's a planning option, whether it makes sense to start to consider that if not now, at some point, the use of Medicaid might make sense because, well, that is an environment in which I would be amenable to receiving those benefits. I did want to make one exception with regard to the Medicare piece. And the Medicare piece, remember I said before to you that long-term care services whether at home or in a facility, are not paid for by Medicare. Medicare is restoring people. They're getting them back. They're rehabbing them. They're getting them back to where they're supposed to be. There is one Medicare program that is an exception to that, and it's one that many people need to consider and look at the definitions for, and that's hospice. When someone is in a situation where not necessarily they're actively dying, but they're in a situation where we've recognized the fact that the care at this point, the appropriate care, is what we in the nursing world call palliative. Comfort, dignity. We're not looking to preserve or extend life. We have no interest in going into the emergency room with everything. We have no interest of ever using an intensive care unit again. Okay? What we want is for someone to be kept relatively free of pain, clean, well cared for, in as least institutional environment as we possibly can. That we call palliative care. Okay? And it's a very important space for lots of folks, probably more folks than actually get the benefit of having that. Folks who really, frankly, would not want to reach the end of their life with, you know, fluorescent lights over their heads and lots of machines beeping. Okay? When you're in that space, it is worthwhile to begin to explore what the Medicare hospice program has. Because hospice simply says this, the voluntary choice. Hospice says, you know what, I'm not interested in all of that expensive medical stuff. Well, Medicare says, whoa, but we were promising to pay for that. So if what you're saying is that's not what you want, would you prefer this package? Now, we're not promising that you can't switch your mind at a later point in time. I get that. There's nothing contractual here. But if truly what you're saying is you don't want this really wickedly expensive stuff that we thought we were going to have to spend on you, we're amenable to instead supporting your decision in that by providing you these other things, which can include social work in addition to the nursing. It can include home health aides, a whole number of other kinds of pieces that go into this. So there is a space where Medicare, their health insurance, their medical insurance, is providing, if you will, non-medical services, non-restorative services, with lots of really good dollars to come in. But it has to be the right context. Financial need shouldn't drive somebody into thinking about palliative care. It should be the other way around. If you're already in a space where you're saying, well, that's what mom would want anyway, then we need to learn a little bit about how the Medicare hospice program works. Now, a physician would need to certify that this person is in a position that they have that level of vulnerability. Okay? And there's some pressure on docs around, you know, is there even a prognostic ability? Does a human being have, even with all the data available, the ability to say that somebody's going to die in the next 6 months or the next year or the next 2 years? There's a real question about that, whether that actually exists. But that's the criterion. The physician would need to say, you know what, looking at this person right now, they are frail enough that they could die within this next period of time. Sorry. It's a rich set of benefits, so and it's worth considering, and that's the reason that I wanted to bring it out to you, because it is the one exception. Yes. Yes, that is correct. That is correct. The VA has a wonderful palliative care program as well, and you know, you could choose to take this if you wish to, and some of my dear colleagues and loved ones that share with me many other pro-life positions. In ways, may see something, you know, dangerous and onerous and shadowy about trying to increase the incentives for people to just die, okay? And I think I look at it in a different way from my perspective as a nurse, particularly, which is, how about we start with what kind of life you want to have? If the life that you want to have requires a level of activity that we need full restorative care for you, and that's what you want, or that's your values, okay, then the truth of the matter is you're entitled, because of the Medicare benefit, to go ahead and knock yourself out, go into the hospital, get all that stuff. But I could argue in the other direction. There are strong financial incentives to provide that very expensive care to people. A lot of people, we're in Cleveland, Ohio, a lot of people make a really good living here by providing all kinds of health services to people. Okay, some of which, by the time they're in those health services, they're not so sure they really wanted this. This wasn't what they cared for. But once you start that snowball rolling downhill, it's very difficult to turn it off. If, on the other hand, to have a deliberate, they call it now increasingly the conversation, to have a deliberate, we'll talk about family meetings, conversation to say, what do you want? Well, I don't want to hurt. Got that covered. That doesn't take a hospital to have that. I'd like to be home. Ooh, now we're leaning more towards something because a lot of the medical stuff we're talking about, you wouldn't be. Okay. I want to be around you guys. I want you to be near me. Start teasing out what the real priorities are if this were, I mean, honestly, this is a very good exercise for all of us to take. Okay. The life coach that my wife and I were blessed to work with, that probably prompted a lot of my decisions to go back to the university at this point in my career, was a conversation, one of which was, okay, turns out this is your last 90 days. Where you want to be? God was kind enough to just give you this amazing prophetic word that says, these are the last months of your life. What do you want to be doing? And it brought out a very different kind of conversation about values if you work from the end backward. And it's a conversation that is worthwhile having with our parents in that regard. And a difficult one, difficult one. You're probably going to cry more than they will, but and that's a good thing. But one that we want to discuss because the planning and the use of the services should not be driven by either the urgency of the moment clinically or money, ever. The planning should be driven by those kinds of conversations about value. Okay. Let's take a break. 10 minutes or so. Okay, grab some coffee. Vicky always treats us very, very well, so please enjoy that. Move around a little bit because I'm going to hit you with more of the taking a sip of water from a fire hydrant. Okay? Thanks.